You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 9th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, folks.
How's everyone doing this evening?
Much better than last week.
Not too bad.
Yay. You sound better, Jay.
Yeah. I was very sick. I was not feeling well. And I wanted to thank everybody, all of our patrons. Again, I don't feel like I was as enthusiastic last week as I should have been. And something else cool, just to give you guys a quick update. So I've been on the hunt for the original Star Trek, the original series chairs that they use on the set. You know, they're all over the ship, but on the bridge, yeah. There's two different styles of chairs. There's with arms and without arms. The ones on the bridge, like the one that you see Spock and Uhura sit in, they don't have arms on them. Well, I have finally figured out exactly what those chairs are, and after 2 years of surfing eBay, I found a great deal, and I bought four of them.
Of course you did.
And now I have to. What do you call it when you – I'm not retrofitting the chairs. I am decking the chairs out Star Trek style with all the accoutrements that they need to look like the chairs on the show. But you will be seeing those chairs on the SGU set probably within a month.
Okay, so when I am there visiting, who has to sit in the kids' chair?
I don't think we're going to be sitting in those chairs. I think they're going to be a set decoration in the background.
Gotcha. Oh, yeah, because if you're sitting in the chair behind a table, you can hardly even see it.
You can't see it, right.
Yeah, good call. Makes sense. Then it'll kind of give the illusion that we're also sitting in the chairs.
Yeah, but I'm just one step closer to turning our studio into the original series bridge, pretty much.
That's cool. I like that. Yeah. I can't wait to see it. Guys, something really cool happened this week. I did a gift exchange with all of my nerdy friends, and just beforehand, I was finally able to get a copy of our book, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, to an individual whose copy had been burned in the California wildfires. Do you remember when I was, we were all together. Where were we, in DC?
Yes.
I think so, yeah. And so I brought a copy of the book, you guys all signed it, and it was for an individual named David Starkopf and his girlfriend, Anna, who, David's the operations director of a summer camp and retreat center in Malibu. And unfortunately, the entire place burned down. So not just his home, but his work. Yeah, and I mean, super rough after these last wildfires. And he reached out and said, you know, we had an unintentional book burning. And I was like, oh gosh. So we signed a new copy. And long story short, timing didn't work out. You stop. The timing didn't work out. And I had to leave it in the mailbox for him because I wasn't able to meet up with him. So he went and picked it up from the mailbox. And when I opened up my mailbox later that day, there was a gift inside. I thought it might be for one of my nerd friends, but it turns out that they took the book and left a book in exchange, which is literally the sweetest thing ever. Yeah. And it's so cool, you guys. It's Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, but it's annotated for scientists and engineers.
Oh, awesome.
Great. Isn't that so cool?
Wow. Oh, man.
I know. I can't wait to read it. And I'll tell you guys what I think with all the annotations. But how sweet is that?
It's pronounced Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. Thank you for that.
Bob, you're going to give us the first forgotten superhero of science for the year.
Nancy Grace Roman, 1925 to Xmas. Christmas Day, 2018, just recently passed. Hmm. She's considered the mother of the Hubble telescope and an advocate for women in science. So, like many future astronomers, Roman looked at the night sky, as many of us did, and dreamed of the stars. She helped start an astronomy club at school and, of course, received pushback at her interest in science. Because, I mean, she was born in 25, so we're talking, 30s to the 40s and 50s. Not a great time for women in science. So she once said, "I still remember asking my high school guidance teacher for permission to take a second year of algebra instead of a fifth year of Latin. She looked down her nose at me and sneered, 'What lady would take mathematics instead of Latin?'" And Roman said that was the sort of reception that I got most of the way. That said, Roman did not have problems with her male colleagues after she got a job at NASA. She said that, "I was accepted very readily as a scientist in my job. The men were very cooperative, and I felt that the men treated me as one of the team without a problem." So that's really cool. Way to go, NASA. So while at NASA, she was the first woman to hold an executive position there as first chief of astronomy in NASA's Office of Space Science. That's what a cool job that must have been. In that capacity, she did many things like traveling and giving lectures at astronomy departments. And during that time, she would often extol to astronomers how beneficial it would be for them to make observations from space. So that's obviously a good segue. Roman was also involved in launching many orbital solar and astronomical observatories and satellites. And one program that she was deeply involved in was the earliest stages of, you guessed it, the Hubble telescope. So she set up the program structure and other fundamental contributions. Because of that, she's often called the mother of Hubble. I'd never heard of that before. So let's see, astronomer Edward J. Wheeler, who worked with Roman at the agency, added, regretfully, history has forgotten a lot in today's internet age. But it was Nancy in the old days before the internet and before Google and email and all that stuff who really helped to sell the Hubble Space Telescope and organize the astronomers who eventually convinced Congress to fund it. So, wow. So remember Nancy Grace Roman? Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing high-speed photometers, point spread functions, or even better, the Cosmic Assembly Near Infrared Deep Extragalactic Legacy Survey. Oh, almost got it 100%.
Yeah. That was good, though.
She was cool.
Yeah, I didn't know Hubble had a mother at all in that context, certainly. Yeah.
I mean, Hubble
intellectual
had a
mother.
Yeah.
Yes.
The dude probably had a mother.
Yeah, she was way at the beginning.
She's the other mother, I guess.
Nice. Quarter line.
All right. Thanks, Bob. So, Kara, this is an interesting use of new AI deep learning algorithms for diagnosis. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this kind of piggybacks off of, was it Jay's story last week?
Or Bob's about the
mine.
It was Bob's. Okay. Yeah, about the AI. This is an article that was just recently published, I think January 9th, in Nature Medicine, identifying facial phenotypes of genetic disorders using deep learning. So medical application, really interesting. The technology is called Deep Gestalt. And the platform, or I should say the app, is called Face2Gene. And this is actually a smartphone application that physicians will hopefully soon be able to use in more regularly. Right now, it's still being tested. And it's a face scanning app. So the idea here is that a physician could take a photo or scan in a photo of a patient that has some signs of potentially having a genetic disorder, a rare genetic disorder, and the app will hopefully be able to discriminate what that genetic disorder is based on a deep learning algorithm. So let's talk a little bit about what they did to test it, because it's a little bit complicated, but they did two different types of tests to show that they are feeling pretty confident about this Face2Gene app. The first one was more of a binary distinction test, and apparently that's how historically these kinds of networks have been classified. So the idea is, does the individual appear to have, for example, Cornelia de Lange syndrome, or does the individual not have Cornelia de Lange syndrome? But what I don't mean is, are they not sick or are they not diagnosed? What I mean is, do they have some other syndrome? And that's important. So have it or not have it, meaning have something else. And they tested both of those. They tested a binary system using both Cornelia de Lange syndrome and something called Angelman syndrome. And I've never heard of either of these, likely because they're rare. Steve, have you come up? You have. Okay.
Yeah, because they have neurological involvement. So when you're studying pediatric neurology, you learn all of these genetic syndromes, because most of them can be a presentation of cognitive delay.
Sure. Okay. So I looked both of these up online because I wasn't sure what they were, because they're not really described in the journal article. Cornelia de Lange, it says physical, cognitive, and medical challenges all the way from mild to severe. It's got a really varied phenotype, which obviously is going to make it hard. Phenotype, again, being what it looks like, kind of the morphology. The phenotype is the expression of the genotype. Long or thick eyebrows, small nose, small stature, developmental delay, thin upper lip, downturned mouth, long or smooth. What is this, Steve? Philtrum?
Yeah, that's the thing between the nose and the mouth.
And then Angelman syndrome is another, you know, extremely rare genetic disorder. These are the kinds of genetic disorders that have many foundations around them and that we don't often come across in everyday life. And even physicians don't often come across in everyday life. So they did this binary distinction using that, and they found that it did really, really well. So with Cornelia de Lange, they put in 614 images of Cornelia de Lange and 1,079 other images, and it was able to distinguish it with a 96.88% accuracy. They did something similar with Angelman, where they fed in 766 Angelman syndrome images, and these they pulled from medical journals and from these image databases that they've been compiling, and 2,669 non-Angelman images. And they got an accuracy of 92%. And this deep gestalt accuracy is significantly higher than previous studies that have used neural nets in the past. They do state in the article, though, that previous studies were usually using much smaller cohorts. So the number of images were very, very small. And that could have explained why the accuracy is so improved with deep gestalt. Now, they haven't really done a lot of direct clinical comparisons with this. I think those are next stages. They've done some non-controlled clinical comparisons where it outperformed individuals who are pretty good at this and do this as a regular part of their job. But the next step of the research is going to be to compare to actual clinicians and see how well deep gestalt does. But what the researchers are saying is that, A, this could be added as a secondary layer of confidence for physicians, but probably even more likely, what they could do is use this as a screening tool so that they don't do these broad-based genetic screens that can be incredibly costly when you have no idea what genetic disorder you're testing for. You run a face through deep gestalt through the app Face to Gene. And then hopefully you get at least some idea of, like, it's highly likely it's this disorder. We have a low level of likelihood that it's this disorder. Maybe you narrow it down to your top five or your top 10. And then you can do a genetic test for those things. And that would save a lot of money. Of course, there are some fears around this. We have our standard fears around this becoming something that's monetized and privatized and not open access. So you get this commodification of a smaller data set that's actually exclusive. There are some fears around what I've been seeing articles of. I've been sharing them a lot recently about ethnic bias. So, you know, garbage in, garbage out. So, you know, your data set and your algorithm, even if we're talking about a neural net, is always only as good as the data it has access to. And so what we have seen in the past, though, is that as you feed more unbiased data into a data set, you're going to have better outcomes. And they tell kind of a short story of Face2Gene being utilized in a 2017 study where they looked for Down syndrome, and they showed an 80% accuracy rate in white Belgian children with Down syndrome, but it was only 37% for Congolese children that were Black. But that's because it's very likely that they didn't feed in enough images of Black children with Down syndrome. And when they started to train the set with more diversity, it actually did improve. So luckily, we know that this is a problem that can be improved upon. But of course, we also have all the same fears around privacy. I mean, this is a story that we keep hearing. So it's a super interesting application. It's really cool to see the improvement in just a few years of how well these things are doing. And I mean, gosh, what an important feature for parents of children who do have these rare genetic disorders that live in rural areas or areas where they just don't have specialists who are around to be able, you know, who can't afford to go to the NIH to try and get something like this diagnosed. It's just really cool to see this improvement happening.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I found interesting about this. The first is that, like, one of the things that the human brain is really good at is pattern recognition. And often, you know, diagnosing these genetic syndromes, yes, you may look for some very specific features, but it's often the gestalt, hence the name of that software. You're just looking, you look at the person and they look like somebody, you know, pattern recognition wise with Angelman or Noonan's or whatever.
Yeah, like Down syndrome is a good example of that for those of us like laymen who don't come across this a lot. Like, we've all known people with Down syndrome and we know what Down syndrome looks like. That said, we don't know necessarily. We might just assume everybody who has a Down syndrome type phenotype has Down syndrome, when really it could be any number of other genetic
disorders.
There
could be other things, right. Mm-hmm. But there's something we call FLK, which stands for funny looking kid, which just means that that there's something not right. You know that the child has some syndrome. They have microcephaly or
fetal alcohol syndrome.
They have abnormal features. But knowing which specific syndrome they fit based upon the constellation of syndromes takes a lot of familiarity. But when you do get familiar with it, the pattern recognition can be very, very high. So I do wonder how well this will do against experienced clinicians. Obviously, it'll be really helpful for rare syndromes and clinicians that are not familiar with those syndromes. But I also do wonder if parents are going to start using it.
outside
of the context. Yeah, they're just going to take a picture of their kid and go, oh my God, what does my kid have? This leads to so many unnecessary consultations. It probably leads to some necessary ones too. But people having access to health information on the internet absolutely drives a utilization of healthcare resources.
I didn't even think about that false positive issue. Yeah. And it feeds directly into something that I flagged early on but never followed up with, which was there are no studies yet using this algorithm that are discriminatory of Noonan syndrome or healthy.
Right.
You know, Angelman syndrome or healthy. All they do is feed in these massive databases of genetic disorders. So they're going to say that any child fed into it has a genetic disorder. They're just going to pick the one that seems most likely. There's no part of the algorithm that says, no, they don't have a genetic
disorder. They have nothing. Yeah. So they have to feed that in there. Well, clinicians learn that you need to know the range of normal before you could determine that something is abnormal. Mm-hmm. And that this needs to learn that too.
It
needs to learn
because without it, you're right.
Of what
any parent who puts it in is going to get a hit. It's like using WebMD. Like, you always are dying of cancer.
Right.
Which is not good.
Yeah. Right. All right. Thanks, Kara. We have another medical one. This one is at the other end of the spectrum, unfortunately. Actually, this is good news, but I'm going to talk about some not so good. It's like there's actually three items I'm going
to
talk about together.
Get to it.
They all deal with cancer. The first one is good news. So you ready for the good news first?
Yes, of course.
Ready to go.
Good news, everyone.
Yes, the 2019 data is in for cancer rates in the United States. Provided by the American Cancer Society. Yeah, and the cancer death rate continues to decline, pretty much at exactly the rate it has been declining for the last 10 years plus, which is good. So overall, I know we talked about this last year, and it's basically the exact same news item as last year. It's just, those same trends have continued for another year.
Nice.
If you extrapolate, what does that mean for the next 10 years or 20 years?
It'll keep going down.
It'll keep going down.
Now, Steve, you can't
extrapolate everything forever.
Oh, thank you. Wow. It'll keep going down.
Is this due to improvements in the actual medicine, or is it there are other factors?
There's other factors, but let me give you the quick overview. So the rate of cancer has been pretty stable. So the number of new people getting cancer, the cancer incidence, some have been going up a little bit, some have been going down a little bit, but it's all averaging out. Mainly the big ones going down are lung cancer because of decreased smoking.
Good.
Colorectal cancer is going down because people are getting their colonoscopies. And prostate cancer is going down, but that's an artifact because we stopped doing PSA screening for prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. So we're just diagnosing less of it. But the big win there is fewer people smoking, less lung cancer. And that's actually the biggest single, I think, factor that we're seeing in there. There's been a little uptick in liver cancer, probably due to hepatitis C rates, which cause liver cancer. A little bit of increase in thyroid cancer, which is almost certainly a diagnostic artifact. We're diagnosing smaller, earlier lesions. And a little bit of an uptick in melanoma, probably due to increased sun exposure. So those are all pretty explainable as either diagnostic artifacts or changes in risk factors.
Is the science of preventative care for cancer getting better, though?
Sure. It's all getting better. But now let's talk about people with cancer. So this is now not what's causing cancer, but if you have cancer, that your survival has been steadily increasing. The death rate from cancer has been steadily decreasing. And that's due to a number of factors. One factor is that treatments are getting better. They are just straight up improving incrementally every year. We're taking another 1% to 2% off of the death rate for cancers overall. Obviously, some cancers better than others. There's also a little bit of a lead time bias. We're diagnosing it earlier. right? And so if you diagnose it earlier, it makes it seem like people live longer, right? Because you're finding out in the earlier stage. But that's easy to control for epidemiologically, the lead, what's so-called lead time bias. And even if you do control for that, people are just dying less with cancer. So that's because of the treatment. So in this way, cancer is like batteries, battery technology. Right. You'll read about battery technology breakthroughs all the time.
Just like we think about all the time.
Cancer treatment breakthroughs all the time. But in the aggregate effect is that where every year our battery storage is getting a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit. Same thing with solar, you know, efficiency, it's getting a little bit better. And same thing with cancer. We're not curing it, but all of the cumulative effect of all of these advances is leading to this steady 1% to 2% decline in death rate from cancer over the last 20 plus years.
Steve, important question.
Yeah.
Would you rather have a battery that's 10 times better storage-wise than what we have today, or would you rather see cancer rates drop significantly?
Oh, cancer rates.
Yeah,
are you sure? Because think about how great it would be to not have to charge your cell phone.
I know, but you know.
Jay.
All right. Oh boy.
So just the overall numbers, what this means is that between 1991 and 2016, the cumulative decrease in cancer deaths is 27%. That's huge.
Wow.
That means that 2.6 million people would have died in the last 15 years or 20 years were it not for this steady improvement, right? So that's 2.6 million lives, people with cancer saved. Because of advances in treatment.
Good now, results.
Yeah, so that's good. It's a win for science. It shows you the incremental nature. That's just cumulative incremental advances do add up over time. But there isn't going to be this big dramatic breakthrough or cure or anything like that. But that's okay as long as the steady increases keep coming.
Right.
Compare that to a previous news item that we talked about, people who choose alternative treatments for cancer. Well, they die faster. They die much faster, depending on the type of cancer. It could be as 4 or 5 or even 6 times the rate of people who don't use alternative treatments to treat their cancer. So alternative treatments kill. That is the bottom line.
Yep.
Using science works. Using fake medicine will kill you. And along those lines of fake medicine, this is another item I wrote about recently, and David Gorski's wrote about it as well. It's a big item for science-based medicine. Studies showing that increasingly people are using crowdfunding sources to fund their cancer quackery. This is now becoming a major avenue of funds going to quacks and charlatans for their fake cancer treatments, which is very, very unfortunate.
Yeah. So we need some oversight here.
But there isn't any. What oversight?
FTC. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's just the thing about crowdfunding. It's, you know, there's no advertisement really. It's people saying, "Hey, give me money so I could do this." Okay, you know, there's at what point would what regulatory agency get involved? You could only really get involved if the people providing the treatment are making false claims or practicing medicine without a license. That's already the case. But I don't know. This needs to be self-imposed. And I just don't see that happening. Why would GoFundMe take the high road like this? I just doubt
it's the right thing to do.
I know, but I doubt that they're critical thinking enough to really understand what they're doing.
Well, let's send them our book.
It's so easy. It's so easy to take we're not judgmental about things like this. Who knows? And give me billions of dollars. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's too much of an incentive to be open-minded and who's to say whatever. So I don't know. Can you think of a way? I can't think of a regulatory option here. As you say, Bob, the only option is really teaching critical thinking. But you're talking to people who are staring down cancer, and it's hard. You know,
It's like we have to see a social change, like something that's happening across the board. And it's true, like whether it's regulatory, maybe that's not the right option, but at least to have people in positions of political power stating that this is charlatan, this is snake oil.
We have to regulate the practitioners, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Like really, really crack down on the practitioners.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And the more that they start to see news articles, you know, in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or the Washington Post of like people going to jail for doing alternative medicine.
For practicing medicine without a license. That's what used to happen back before health fraud became legitimized. All right. So it's like this. I had to present these side by side. On the one hand, we're making huge cumulative advances in science-based medicine, and yet people are still opting for the fake bullshit. And it's just very frustrating. And to their death, they are opting for nonsense to their death.
And but then there's also these, you know, arguments outside of that that were like, if that's somebody's choice, that's their choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it becomes like a freedom of, you know, like the problem is they don't have all the information.
Yes. Yeah. They are being exploited. They're not making an informed consent decision.
Yeah, if they knew that they were going to die by going this route at a 5 times higher rate, they probably wouldn't choose that route.
Yeah, you can't say, oh, it's their free choice, but they're being lied to and given misinformation.
Right.
No, that's not a free choice. By definition, informed consent means you are given accurate information.
Exactly. And then if you make that decision, if you say, I'm sorry, I don't want to do chemotherapy, I'd rather take my chances.
That's fine. That's fine.
But
yeah. But if you're like, I'm not going to do it because this person over here told me they could cure me with magic water, that's a different story.
Yep.
All right. The next two items are also both related. They are both environmental items. Jay, you're going to talk first about how are we going to clean up all the trash in our oceans?
So the trash that we generate, a lot of it ends up in our waterways, and then it eventually trickles down into the ocean. If not, is directly dumped into the ocean, sadly. So it's hard. It's really hard to clean up all our trash when it's on the ground, but it's really hard to clean up garbage that's in the ocean, especially because a lot of it sinks to the bottom of the ocean. So you guys might have heard about this company called Ocean Cleanup. They created this 600-meter-long device that catches plastic and other debris that's floating on the surface of the water. So it has a net that goes down about 3 meters. And recently, part of the upper tube, the buoyant part of it, broke off. I read that some people were saying that it actually broke in half. Now, it turns out, like I said, that cleaning the ocean water is really complicated. It's really difficult. And this device was originally designed to collect the debris. And the company found out that they were having a problem having the trash stay in the device once it was captured. Some of the trash was escaping, which was, you know, not the way that they wanted it to behave. And then, of course, the thing broke in half, and then they had to tow it back to Hawaii for some engineering updates and repairs. And, you know, this project has detractors. I mean, I was very positive about it. I didn't really, you know, quite understand how complicated this was. I thought it made perfect sense. But it turns out that this could be harmful to ocean animals that live near the surface of the water. And it really is not getting rid of that much trash. Even if it worked as designed, it wouldn't get rid of that much trash because, like I said, most of it has sunk to the bottom of the ocean, or at least is way below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was reading about this, Jay, it really sounded very similar to me to the space junk problem.
Yeah.
There's a lot of it. It's getting in the way, and there really isn't any easy way to get rid of it. And I thought about it, like, yeah, that's right. How are you going to filter the oceans without taking out all the fish, right? That's the big challenge. Like, how do you capture trash and not capture wildlife?
Yeah, the sad thing is that there, just like space debris, there isn't a simple panacea here. There isn't an easy way to do it. And what they're saying, just like space debris, Steve, I love that you compared those two, is let's not create any more. Let's focus on doing the things that we have control over. So let me give you a couple of things that people have come up with, things that are being used today, and then some philosophy that we can go over here. So the other systems like Mr. Trash Wheel. I don't know if you guys have heard of Mr. Trash Wheel.
Oh, yeah. He's got those eyes on him.
The googly eyes. Yeah, so it's a big device that was deployed in Baltimore. Actually, they made three of them. Actually, they have Mr. Trash Wheel. They have Mr. what are these other ones? Like, I can't remember. Like General Trash something. You know, like all these
General Trash.
Oh, no, it's Captain Trash and Trash Gordon. Professor Trash Wheel. Yeah. So what these
are. We all have to come up with a name now.
Okay. I got Trash Gordon.
Trash Gordon is good, Evan. That's Trash Gordon.
Mine is Mr. Trash-tastic or Trash Talker.
Trash Talker.
All right. Okay. So listen to this. They use the giant wheel to collect trash that is in a river that before it gets down into the harbor. And it works pretty well. You know, they deployed three of them. It started doing this in 2014. So in 2018, the three trash wheels collected 680,000 kilograms or roughly 1.5 million pounds of trash. That's a lot of garbage that they've collected.
It's a lot, but it's also a drop in the bucket.
It's a dent.
I know, but it's three devices. You know, it's not like we've massively deployed these. Well, you know, these are a test to see how things are going to work. You know,
well, and wait, those function. Are in Boston, right? They're not in
Baltimore,
the ocean,
Baltimore.
Are they? Oh, Baltimore. They're not in the ocean, are
no,
they?
No, that's the whole idea. No. Is that where you're gonna filter out garbage before it gets to the ocean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're like in some the waterways of, there.
Rivers feeding into the ocean. Yeah.
So even though it's a drop in the bucket, it might not be considering like the per capita of the river. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know per capita is not the right word to use, but yeah, it's a drop in the ocean when compared to a drop in the bucket when compared to the ocean. But it might actually be pretty effective in those waterways.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you did it to like the all major rivers around the world, basically cut off the trash stream into the ocean before it gets there. Yeah, it could have a huge
makes
impact.
It easier. Yeah, at least easier to collect, I would think. Maybe not quantity, but just less daunting.
And you know, the ocean also spits out trash back at us, and it washes up on a lot of beaches. Like there's a, you know, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Marine Debris Program. They've been collecting plastics and other debris that have washed ashore in Alaska on the Alaskan coastline since 2006, and they've gathered 450 tons. Another thing that was being done, they collected plastic that was washing ashore on the California beaches. They had, I think, over 1,000 people donate time to do this, and they found that 7% of the plastic that they found were supermarket grocery bags.
Mm-hmm.
So back in 2010 –
don't use those, man.
Yeah, we do. My wife and I bring –
they're not even legal in my city anymore.
That's what the regulations are really the way to go, Kara, because what happened was California passed some laws, and it went from – it was 7% of the plastic that was collected, and it dropped down to 2% in 2017 just from regulations.
Well, Jake, just to finish what you were talking about, so the important thing there is that debris washes up on the shore – but then it goes back out again when the tide goes out. So if you clean it up when it comes in, it's basically an automatic trash sorting mechanism. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we should take advantage of that. Just constantly clean the trash up as it washes up on shore so it doesn't recirculate back into the ocean.
That'd but it's nice. Only like a fraction of the trash that's out
it's
there.
True, but it's a lot of it is the bigger plastic before it breaks down into the smaller plastic, which is what is a bigger problem for wildlife.
Get it while you can capture it. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, like Kara was saying, like so much of it is in the ocean. Like we have microplastics. These are like the tiny little beads that they would put in cosmetics and things like that. I guess they use them for abrasion, you know, like to get rid of dead skin. They were banned in 2017. And these little plastic beads, you know, we were finding that they're like getting into food supplies and water supplies. Like they're really scary.
They're everywhere because they're microscopic. You really can't see them. There's the other plastic beads. The ones that are actually used as the raw material to make stuff in plastic.
Yep.
And those end up in the ocean a lot too because tankers, like actual boats, will lose their cargo. And then you'll have like an entire cargo ship full of these plastic beads.
Of raw plastic, yeah, that's terrible.
Dumped into the ocean. Like that's not uncommon. Yeah. So yeah, but those are slightly bigger. You can actually see them, but they're still really small. And yeah, I mean, we've all seen the images, right? Like this is, and it's not the exception to the rule. I think we used to think of it as like, oh, that one island in the middle of nowhere. Can you believe they found that bird with all that trash in its digestive tract? It's like literally every time there's a dead seabird anywhere, it's full of plastic.
Well, one of the ideas that they came up with to help this at its source. You ever hear of something called extended producer responsibility? This is something I think that's really going to work. And it's been gaining ground recently. So the extended producer responsibility means that companies who create plastic products are being held responsible for the cost to dispose of the products that they're actually collecting. Right. So at its core, the idea is to put a financial responsibility on these companies, right? That's going to make them do things. And what they're hoping that these companies will do, if they're charging them to dispose of or just a fee, look, you produced X number of tons of plastic, you're going to have to pay more money to the government to get rid of that plastic.
So what otherwise, they're hoping, it's an externalized cost, right? It's a cost that they're profiting from that is they're dumping onto the public.
So there are different kinds of plastic, and what they're hoping is if they do this, that these companies will use more recyclable plastic. Or like here's a quick example. Like they can combine different kinds of plastic in one product. And some types of plastic are very easy to recycle, and some types of plastic you can't recycle. So you have to go through a process. It could be chemicals. It could be like lots of different ways that they would extract the recyclable plastic from the non-recyclable plastic. And that's bad for the environment, and they still have to dispose of the bad stuff. So the idea is use better materials that are more green and get to the point where your footprint shrinks and put the burden on these companies. Because if we did have plastic that was biodegradable, or, you know, we come up with different materials here that are much more green and companies started to use them, you know, over time we would see a massive improvement. And a lot of the stuff that's being dumped in the ocean right now, it wouldn't be as bad, right? What if they came out with a plastic? I'm just making this up here. What if they came up with a plastic that over time, you know, maybe after being submerged in salt water for a couple of years, it'll disintegrate? That would be fantastic. You know what would be cool? This would be a big deal, but wouldn't it be cool if when we went to the supermarket, any liquids that we wanted to buy, we could just bring, you know, our own stainless steel metal container, like maybe they wash it real quick there. They have a machine that will wash it.
You do that.
Yeah, you can in like hippie supermarkets. That's the thing. Like they're really big in places like LA, but a lot of people have a like upturned nose about that kind of a vibe because also these are the same places that only sell organic food.
Yeah, it's like, wait, now am I going to have to learn how to play like the conga drum or something if I start doing
that's
this?
That's what I'm saying. That's the annoying thing, but those are the kinds of places where they sell raw oats and like nuts and things in these big bins, and you bring your own container to fill them up. They sell water where you can fill it up, coffee, things like that with your own containers. The juice, like there's a place in LA called Air One, and they have these great juice bottles, and their milk and their soups, they all come in these glass bottles that they give you a credit when you bring them back to the store. But the problem is these are the places where they sell like raw goat milk because apparently cow milk is unhealthy. And they have only organic free range blah. And so there's this weird crossover in those mentalities.
Yeah, they're it's mixing annoying. The useful stuff with the nonsense stuff.
It's kind of annoying. Package deal. Yeah. It's really annoying.
Refill your homeopathy.
You're going to find tons of homeopathy there.
Yeah. We could take all the trash and put it into orbit. Oh, wait a minute. That's like, you ever do this thing where like
trash up there?
You clean your attic and you put everything in the garage. Then you clean the garage, you put it all in the basement. Then you clean your basement, you put it back in the attic.
Yeah. No, I've never done that.
Gotta be somewhere.
We need to create a bacteria that eats plastic and poops gold.
There is a bacteria that eats plastic. It's just they haven't been able to scale it yet.
They're working on it.
Come on.
And it's going to poop, you know, gasoline. Not gold.
You're right.
But that's turn plastic into something usable, chemically usable, maybe even convertible into biofuel or whatever.
Yeah, let's do it.
Do it.
Yeah.
Then we can set the ocean on fire, you know? It'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. Soon. Jesus.
All right, Evan, if this weren't enough, the butterflies are dying.
This is sad. This is really sad.
Have they been hanging out with the bees? What's going on?
Yeah, is that the old adage? I forget. It's been so long.
That's the birds and the bees.
Right. The whole birds things. News from, the researchers at the Xerces Society. And they help track the number of Western monarch butterflies that migrate along the California coast. They've described the current migration season's numbers of butterflies as disturbingly low. They've recorded fewer than 30,000 butterflies so far this season than last season, and that represents an 86% decline since last season, the 2017 season. Yikes. Compare it to this. The group in 1981 counted more than 1 million Western monarchs wintering in California. Mm-hmm. 1981, 1 million. 2018, 30,000.
Yep, that's a big difference.
Awful.
Yeah.
Yep. So what happens is that each year, monarchs in the western United States migrate from inland areas to California's coastline to spend the winter. And the season usually runs between September and February. So the season's not over yet, but it's not looking very good in the final tally. According to Emma Pelton, who's a conservation biologist with the society, she said it's been the worst year we've ever seen. We already know we're dealing with a really small population, and now we have a really bad year, and all of a sudden we're kind of in crisis mode when we have very, very few butterflies left.
Yeah, I looked into this a little bit myself, too. So just to be clear, this is the Western monarch butterfly.
Right.
And they winter in along the California coast. There's also the eastern monarch butterfly, right, guys? That's the one we would see.
Yes.
They winter in Mexico. So fortunately, while they're down like 14% this year, it's not bad. So the eastern monarchs are hanging on, although their numbers are overall declined as well. Mm-hmm. So both eastern and western monarchs are massively declined, but the westerns took a huge hit this year, while the eastern's only a small hit of about 14%. And it's not really clear why, but although I think the wildfires have played a role. I mean, they've burned up all the milkweed, right?
Yeah, they definitely have. Yeah, that's the key thing. In the places I've read, they said the number one thing you can do is plant more milkweed, because the butterflies will lay their eggs on the underside of the milkweed plants.
But you got to be careful, because a lot of people have been planting the wrong kind of milkweed.
You have to get native milkweed.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it has to be the right kind.
Yeah, I heard some people were trying to smoke it.
And if you live in L.A., I know it's a small percentage of our listeners, but if you do, go to the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. They will give you milkweed seed packets for free.
Just the good ones.
Yeah, they want. Oh,
that's
good.
That's a great idea.
Ones.
That's cool.
It's really cool.
And it's great. You attract butterflies, and their monarch butterflies are beautiful. They really are.
And their caterpillars are beautiful.
Yeah.
So, and you understand the importance of this, because for one full cycle to occur, that is, for these butterflies, once the winter season is over, they head back out towards the rest of the country. And it takes 4 to 6 generations of butterflies in order to make one complete circle, right?
Mm-hmm.
One complete cycle. So the milkweed is so important, because you're helping out in giving them the space that they need in order to repopulate, which is, you know, obviously critical. But obviously we're also having quite an impact on land usage and other things that we're doing to impact the environment that is taking away the milkweed that is precious. Not to mention, especially in the Midwest, where milkweed can be toxic to certain livestock, farmers and, you know, in big swaths of land out there, they're reluctant to kind of have it hanging around their farmlands.
Yeah, to them it's a weed. And that gets back to the land usage thing again, which once again is a good case for genetically modified agriculture. To reduce our land use, you could plant milkweed instead of that.
Totally. I want to give a quick shout out, Evan, if you don't mind. Two of my good friends, Jason Goldman and Phil Torres, have a company where they work with Atlas Obscura to do these really cool ecotourism science sort of hosted travel, like trips around the world. They do Galapagos, they do Ecuador, and one of them is the Mexico Great Monarch Butterfly Migration.
Yes, I watched videos on YouTube
of the
forest where all those eastern monarchs migrate to in this basically one forest. They say, I think it's about 44 acres large. So it's a real, relatively small concentrated area.
It's El Rosario Butterfly Sanctuary. That's one of them, but there are a few others. There's the Sierra Chinchua. It's amazing. It's millions of butterflies all at once, like just in the trees. And yeah, they do a trip so you can go and visit them and see it in person. And I think these kinds of things, even though only a select few people, I think, have the means to be able to do that, are really important ways to drive that message home, is to see it in person.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So check it out. Atlas Obscura.
All right, Bob, you're going to end up the news item section with a talk about when galaxies collide.
So, yeah, this is fascinating for me. New simulations show that the next big merger of our galaxy, the Milky Way, will not be in 4 billion years with the Andromeda, as we had all thought, and which I have been telling people for years, but in half that time, with a nearby small satellite galaxy called the Large Magellanic Cloud. All because of dark matter. I guess this is cool. We don't have to wait for Andromeda, which is 2 million light years away, to get its ass over here. But of course, technically, we're both approaching each other, aren't we? Because it's gravity. This is the conclusion of the Eagle Project, a computer simulation run on some of the biggest supercomputers on the planet. Astrophysicists at Durham University and University of Helsinki published their results early in January in 2019 in the peer-reviewed journal Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. So the Large Magellanic Cloud, but it's a small galaxy, about 160,000 light years away. That may sound far, but it really isn't. It's actually one of the the third closest galaxy, I believe. And it's a little weird looking because it's in a transitional form between a small spiral galaxy and an irregular galaxy. 30,000 light years across, so that's only about less than a third of the Milky Way. But if you looked at it, if you looked at it in the southern hemisphere and measured it, it's 20 times the width of the full moon. So which is kind of like Andromeda as well, really far away, but so big. It's far bigger than the full moon, but it's so dim. The Andromeda you can't see. The Large Magellanic Cloud, I think you can see much more easily, but it's still not glaring. They're saying 2 to 10 billion suns. It's a little guy, kind of small. So why do they think this is going to collide? It's because they found a new, previously unseen cache of dark matter suffusing the Large Magellanic Cloud. Marius Cartoon, a scientist at Durham University in the UK, said observations in the last 2 years suggest that the LMC, Large Magellanic Cloud, is embedded in a dark matter halo nearly twice as massive as previously thought. The higher mass of the LMC is what seals its fate, implying that the LMC is more tightly bound to the Milky Way and that it will collide with our galaxy in about 2 billion years. So when they took this new data with this extra dark matter and they ran their simulations, 93% of the simulations show that this collision is going to happen in 2 billion years. So pretty high confidence level, 93% of them. There was much hay being made about the possible effect that this will have on our own particular solar system. Even popular science kind of disappointed me. I know they were trying to be a little bit dramatic, but they said in an article, stars will crash into one another, planets will be left broken and smoldering if they aren't outright vaporized, and nothing will ever be the same. Other sources say something about dislodging our solar system and sending it flying. And that's a little annoyed me a little bit because, sure, it's possible. And I bet when you say stuff like that, it brings lots of clicks to your website. But the odds are extremely low that any specific solar system like ours is going to be voted off the island. So that's probably not going to happen. Plus, I mean, the Earth will be a dead cinder in 2 billion years anyway. So it's not like the Earth will be here. But our solar system, of course, will be here for quite a long time, even if it's just the white dwarf and the outer planets left. So the real signs of collision of galactic mergers are actually very fascinating. Actual star collisions themselves, actual stars bumping into each other are very rare because there's lots of empty space out there. But massive molecular clouds, though, they're huge, and they will certainly collide in colliding galaxies if the galaxies still have them. Because if you're a galaxy that has gone through a bunch of mergers already, a lot of your massive clouds of gas are going to probably be depleted anyway, so there's not going to be that much to collide. But if they do collide, that will lead to massive star formation, much, much greater, 30 to 60 times more star formation than you might normally see in if they're big galaxies colliding, like the Milky Way and Andromeda, for example. And these mergers also feed central black holes, which leads to some interesting speculation about the LMC and the Milky Way colliding. Our own supermassive black hole. What's it called? Tell me, what's the name of our supermassive black hole?
Frank?
Oh, they named it Frankie.
Milky Hole.
It's called Sagittarius A star, which is kind of like, it is. I think they could have come up with something that sounds a lot better than that. But it is.
Sagittarius, they named it after Sagittarius. A zodiac?
Sagittarius A star.
Name.
Oh, no, I'm okay with that. The thing is, though.
No, it's named after a constellation, Evan, not the zodiac.
Oh, thank goodness.
The zodiac is named after the constellation.
Well, yeah, I mean, things are named for the constellation that they're in.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But.
But it's ours. Like, it could have. We do different naming designations for things that are like in our neighborhood, like the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
It could be called the black hole of all black holes.
And mother of all black holes.
And actually, our black hole actually isn't, our supermassive black hole isn't actually incredibly supermassive. But they think that collision with the LMC could wake it up from its current dormant, pretty dormant state. And they say that it could potentially increase up to 10 times. This could actually turn the Milky Way into a quasar, active galactic nuclei. So it could actually, if it becomes a quasar, it would start spewing out tons of energy at all wavelengths. and could actually give, if there's any living beings nearby, or even not even nearby, within the galaxy, we'll see some amazing cosmic fireworks. Perhaps even our descendants would see that. So that would be a very interesting sight to see. So yeah, so we got some interesting fireworks happening in two billion years, but that's really just a precursor to the big one in 4 billion years, when the Andromeda and the Milky Way plunge into each other, creating what has been called the Milkomedia, as some of the names that have been thrown around. Not very fond of that one. But
Milkomagnesia.
Yeah, right. So
right.
So yeah, so when the Milky Way merges with the LMC, it'll be like the last little power play that the Milky Way can make before it's kind of absorbed by Andromeda, which is a lot bigger than the Milky Way. It's going to be interesting. 2 billion years, people.
I will reset my Google calendar. Yes, please do.
All right, Jay, before we get to Who's That Noisy, we have a couple of quick announcements. Right, the first one has to do with our other show, Alpha Quadrant 6, which we are finally converting, because so many people asked us to do this, into a podcast.
Yeah, so we are going to take all the episodes that we have, and we're going to download the audio and do the best job we can to turn it into a podcast. And then we're going to be moving forward. We'll be very mindful of the fact that we'll want to also have it double serve as a podcast, but we're going to still be doing the video as well.
Yeah. Just like we did, yeah.
We do. It is a visually based.
True.
It is a visually based topic, because we're talking about, you know, a lot of sci-fi movies and TV shows and things like that. But we're pretty good at describing things, right? At this point, after podcasting for 14 years, so check it out. We're also going to be taking the Alpha Quadrant 6 channel out into its own YouTube channel now, which will give us a little bit more room, so to speak. And we're just really excited about it, because the project is going really well. We love it. And things are just, you know, we're kind of ramping up for Star Trek Discovery Season 2.
Oh, boy.
We have a lot of good movies coming out this year we're excited about. So just go check it out. You can go to facebook.com/AlphaQuadrant and the number 6. And you could also go to our webpage at alphaquadrant6.com. That page should be up very, very soon. So also, we're starting an SGU newsletter. This will be out the first week of February, and we'll have it out the first week of every month. And if you'd like to join or sign up for the newsletter, you can go to our website, or you can go to our Facebook page, and you'll see places to sign up for that. So the good thing about the newsletter is it's going to be a summary of the best bits that the SGU did of the previous month. So as an example, we'll be pointing out some of the best segments that we did, some of the best news items that we found, or any fun or interesting content that we found on the web collectively. Steve will also be writing a letter to, you know, this is basically anyone reading the newsletter. It's not just to our patrons, of course, it's open to the public. And I think it'll be a fun way for you to keep up with what we're doing, and also our schedule of any of events that we'll be doing. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm really excited about it. You know, we only have it a few more weeks before it comes out. Like I said earlier in the show, I would like to thank all of our patrons. We did just reach our 3,000 patron goal. We actually kind of blew past it already, which is fantastic. If you would like to become a patron and support the work that we do, you could go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and join our community. We have a Discord server with a very, very large and daily active community on there. Lots of fun discussions happening literally around the clock. So please come take a look.
Yeah, I think people are excited about our next big goal, which is the 12-hour marathon.
Yeah, that is going to be.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm prepping for that in lots of ways, mostly spiritually. I'm getting myself ready.
Yeah, and yeah, spiritually and physically.
I mean, Steve, we're only about 900 people away from that.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
If the rate keeps up, we'll get there by the end of the year.
It'll be this year.
It'll be this year.
Oh, good. The end of the year. Okay. Yeah. I can prepare for the end of the year.
And it's going to be Zeno's paradox. It's never going to reach it.
Kara?
Yeah.
I'm not prepared for like the next coming month.
Yeah, Jay.
Yeah. I mean, the more patrons we get, the more that we can do. And the 12-hour show is just a celebration, in my opinion, of just life and skepticism. So it's a big deal.
Lack of sleep.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, boy, lack of sleep. Yeah, I'm already dreading it.
Hey, the big one down the road is the 24-hour. Don't forget about that.
Yeah, 12 now hours that's, nothing. Yeah.
All right, Jay, give us Who's That Noisy.
All right, last week I played this noisy. What is this? Ooh, it ramped up. What is that? That is nuts. Any guesses, guys?
No good ones, but...
Yeah, it's something on a door. With the red light attached.
You mean the klaxon?
It's a robot orgy.
All right, so here's a guess from a listener named Marcus Noble. Marcus said, haha, I'm glad God didn't mention me last week after yet another incorrect guess. Wow, Marcus, what are you drinking over there? He said, my guess this week, a large saw starting up at home at a home improvement store. Not, you know,
okay,
not a bad guess, not right. Correct. Another listener named Daniel Karsavar said, hi, the sound this week may be the ignition or start of the LHC. That's a cool guess. It's not correct, yeah, but I would imagine a klaxon is probably involved when you turn on a magnets, you know, magnets of that
magnitude.
Wait,
what's a klaxon?
Klaxon is that. Bang, bang,
bang, bang. I should have just said that then.
Yeah.
That is a funny hole in your knowledge of the world, Kara, that you don't know what a klaxon is.
I didn't know what a klaxon is. And then remember, I feel like it was a few years ago, there was some animal that I had never heard of that was like a dog-like creature.
Yeah, it went like this. La, la, la. La, la, la. La, la, la.
And you said the same thing at the time, Steve. You were like, what a weird hole in your knowledge. It's like, yeah.
Well, it's funny that like, one of my friends once like never didn't know who Spider-Man was. Like, how could you get to this point in your life?
Wait,
and never
this,
hear of Spider-Man.
Was this college level?
This is college level, yeah.
Oh boy.
That's ridiculous. That's real. That's someone that's been reading way too much science then.
Yeah. Or another guy like didn't know what a doggy bag was. Is that a regional thing? Kara, do you want a doggy bag?
Yeah. In the South we say that all the time.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty international. Or national at least.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never
forget.
That's
a take-home container, by the way, in case you don't know what that is.
one of the most well-read and, you know, just educated English speakers that I know is my mother, and she did not know what the word segue meant.
Whoa.
And she was an adult. It just never...
She's got a great vocabulary, too.
Ridiculous vocabulary. I remember talking to her about it, and it was funny because she had zero familiarity. She didn't even have a guess on what it was. All right, anyway, let me continue down the list.
She might have been confused from, she might have thought it was seg, because that's common. People don't, when they see how it's spelled.
Yeah.
Oh, she might have been pronouncing it in her head as seg and didn't know it was
yeah,
segue.
Yeah, so that she might not have known that was segue.
Or segue.
That's really common for people.
It reads a little
funny.
And then
when the segue came out, they were like, oh, that's a segue. That's a different word. That's segway. And so I think I've heard a lot of people have a hard time with the word segue, because they think it's seg.
Okay. Segu.
Yeah.
All right. Segu. So I have one more. This was as close of a guess as anyone got. This is Sharon Roney. And Sharon said, hi, Jay. This week's noisy is obviously the doors opening on the Goodyear Air Dock in Akron, Ohio.
Wow.
So I thought that was pretty close. So what this actually is, this is actually the dome shutters on an observatory opening up.
Cool.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, you ever see like the dome of an observatory? It kind of looks like a half shell, kind of, you know, and the doors have to open up and then they can extend out the telescope or just, you know, that just gives it access to the sky. Very cool. That was sent in by a listener named Don Holdner. So I have a new noisy this week, guys. This noisy was sent in by Attilia Nagy or Nagy or Nagy. This is probably the cutest noisy. It'll be definitely the cutest noisy I will play in 2019, I bet.
Wow.
But it may be one of the cutest noisies of all time. If you think you know what this week's noisy is, or you'd like to email me a cool noisy that you heard this week, this is important. If you did hear anything or find anything on the web, send it to me. I need your entries. You can send that to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right. We have a couple of emails. This is all feedback and one kind of correction. Bob, a lot of people wrote us in to say that you didn't quite characterize the AlphaGo program correctly. What do you know about that?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say a lot of people, a few people. It was and as they said in many emails, it was a minor quibble, but otherwise I was spot on. So let me just throw that out there. No, but it was the initial AlphaGo that that beat the champ in 2016, that was kind of, I think I characterized it as not having any deep learning and more of brute force, kind of like IBM's Deep Blue. And that wasn't quite right. That version was kind of like a fusion. It had some deep learning training as well as the brute force kind of, you know, programming all the moves.
It was a hybrid.
Of course. It was a hybrid. But the AlphaZero, the one that I focused my discussion on, that's the one that was fully deep learning and fully brilliant from first principles and just listening to just learning the rules. And that was it, without any of the other, you know, the hard-won algorithms from humans. So there's that.
And one emailer said that it was overhyped a little bit because they were comparing the AlphaGo on the new one was like on a massive supercomputer and the old one was on a desktop. Like the hardware was not the same, and so it wasn't a fair fight. Did you find anything out about that?
A fair fight between what?
When they were comparing it to the older computers, the older algorithms.
Now, are you talking about AlphaGo going head to head against Stockfish?
I think so. Yeah. Did you have time to look into that at all?
I read some things about that. I didn't see that specific email, but I do know that one of the hallmarks of AlphaZero was that it was going through many, many far fewer options or calculations or moves per second, far fewer, and that goes to show that it was playing much smarter than other systems, because it was doing amazingly well but not looking as, you know, as far ahead as quickly as other systems, showing that the thing is just playing much smarter, like a human, right? Because humans don't look through millions of moves per second like a lot of the brute force ones do, but that's because humans can kind of intuitively go down certain branching paths of moves that are fruitful and just, you know, intuitively ignore the wasted stuff. So, yeah, so that was actually something in favor of AlphaZero.
But we'll keep an eye on this. I do think that there's some people in the industry are still a little skeptical about it's true, how much of a breakthrough it really is versus an incremental advance. But
there was
definitely an advance.
Right. I can speak to that. There was some controversy in the past year or two about, how good is AlphaZero, but the paper that was specifically released that I talk about, at least the research that I did, it supposedly proves that AlphaZero is amazingly dominant and amazingly just a new class of machine that blows away anything prior to it. So that's my understanding of this new paper that was released. It really removes any of the doubt or skepticism of the past couple of years of just how dominant and groundbreaking this new purely deep learning technique is. For these types of games.
We had a few emails about our end of the year show. We used that as an opportunity to talk about our recent visit with the CIA.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Central Intelligence Agency. They invited us down in order to spend the day with them, tour their museum, ask questions about the CIA, et cetera. And I was expecting there to be controversy over that segment. In fact, I was expecting it so much, I recorded a special segment at the end, a disclaimer, if you will, to try to minimize that. And I don't know if it was successful, but there was only a few email feedbacks, but they had the same theme, which flew right in the face of my disclaimer, right?
So, yeah.
The point I was trying to make was, listen, we obviously are aware of the controversy surrounding the history of the CIA, things that they've done, et cetera. This is an old, mysterious, very politically complicated organization. It wasn't our intention, nor is it really within our capability to do any kind of analysis of the actions that the CIA has taken in the past. You know what I mean? This is that's the kind of thing that a real, like, scholarly historian with access to a lot of to access to primary documents or whatever would need to do.
Yep.
Far be it for us to do that. We were basically doing two things. One was evaluating their process, specifically how much of the critical thinking lessons that have been learned over the last 20, 30 years has been incorporated into their process of data analysis. What they say, turning data into intelligence, right? Data is facts. Intelligence is analyzed facts. And when they do that analysis, how much do they incorporate the lessons that have been learned in terms of minimizing bias, you know, minimizing confirmation bias, accounting for multiple perspectives, so-called red teaming, where you assign devil's advocate to say, well, you know, prove to me why what we're thinking is wrong, et cetera. And overall, I thought they had very good answers when we asked them those questions. It seems like the answer is they've incorporated quite a bit of it. They know what they're doing. And the second one was just addressing some very simple myths about just the organization of the CIA and how they operate. That's pretty much it, right? We were not, and people are like, why didn't you talk about their secret war against blah, blah, blah? Because that was totally outside the scope of what we were talking about.
So I think a lot of people were concerned that by visiting the CIA and learning about their process, we were condoning everything they've ever done.
Right. Which is
stamp of approval.
Which is silly.
Yeah.
Or by omission, by not talking about it, we were somehow endorsing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is silly. You know, that wasn't our purpose there. And it is, believe me, this is the conversation we've been having with each other. This is one of the more interesting things that has happened to us because, you know, it's the CIA. You know, we were invited to take a peek, you know, behind the curtain of the CIA. Obviously, everything is public and nothing is classified, but it was still like, yeah, come ask us questions, see how we do things, you know, find out what, you know, misconceptions are about the CIA.
Nothing wrong with
that. Of course we're going to do that. That's what we do. Of course. Yeah. That's not an endorsement of anything that they've done in the past and, or whitewashing the controversy over, you know, their history, et cetera, or anything like that. It's just simply outside the scope of what we were doing. And I'll take this opportunity to say that the CIA has in fact invited us back. And I see no reason why we shouldn't go. This is what we do. We try to provide a bridge between, you know, things like this and the public. You know, we are science communicators, right? Yep. Science and critical thinking. You know, this is an intelligence gathering organization. Obviously, it's overwhelmed with politics, but so is a lot of what we talk about. But we try to talk about the science and the critical thinking and not take a political position on the politics of it, right? That doesn't mean there aren't political implications to the science that we're discussing, but we're talking about the science and critical thinking. Anyway, I thought what was interesting was, I'm like, all right, I'm going to give a disclaimer here to forestall this exact type of feedback, and we still got some emails
with
that exact type of feedback. But
happens.
Anyway, it's interesting. It's actually a lot less than I thought, so maybe mm-hmm. The disclaimer had an effect. We'll see. All right, guys, keep sending us those emails. We love the feedback. The discussion's always very, very interesting, often more important than the segment itself is the conversation that it leads to. So send us those emails. All right, guys, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three news items, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Just three regular news items this week, although these are interesting. I think I found some good ones. I'll be interested to see which of these you guys have encountered already. Here we go. Item number one. Researchers are developing artificial compound eyes for autonomous vehicles and robots because they have superior peripheral vision and motion detection. Item number two, a newly published model predicts that the most cost-effective grid storage between now and 2050 for most applications will be hydrogen. And item number three, astronomers report the detection of the second known repeating FRB source using Canada's Chime radio telescope. FRB is a fast radio burst. We've discussed them on the show several times, including recently. All right, Evan, I won't pick you for 3 weeks in a row.
Oh, okay. So thanks. Thank you.
Jay, go first.
Okay, this first one here, researchers, that they're developing these artificial compound eyes, which means that there's more than one, for autonomous vehicles and robots because they have superior peripheral vision and motion detection.
So, Jay, just to clarify, since you're the first one, compound eyes like insects and crustaceans, like right. arthropods. So
you're talking about the – yeah, that's weird. I've seen simulations of that. Remember in War of the Worlds, the original, when they hooked up that camera to the creature's helmet or head or whatever, and it had like some type of compound eye thing going on? Okay, so this is definitely not just multiple cameras. This is a – you know, multiple cameras that are weaving together like this insect-like thing. And I could see this. I could see that that might help you know, if it works good for insects because, you know, insects that have these types of eyes can see, you know, a much broader range of area. So I think that might be – sounds cromulent enough. So this next one here, the second one, a newly published model predicts that the most cost-effective grid storage between now and 2050 for most applications will be hydrogen. I am a big fan of the future of the grid and going electric. So this hydrogen thing doesn't sound far off to me. I could see us storing energy in hydrogen. It is a pretty compact way to store energy. The real deal is converting it back and forth into, you know, from whatever it is into hydrogen and then out of hydrogen into whatever else we want to turn it into. But that sounds interesting, and I think this one is probably science. The last one, astronomers report the detection of the second known repeating FRB source using Canada's Chime radio telescope. So you're saying here, Steve, to be clear, that there's two now FRBs.
Two repeating FRBs. Repeating. All the other ones are not repeating. They're one-offs.
So there is something about all three of these items that sounds awfully familiar to me, which bothers me, which means I may have read something, but not the whole thing. You bastard. I'm going to say that there's something about the third one, the FRBs, that isn't correct, and that's the fiction.
I'm sorry, which one?
That's correct, right.
The one Jay chose.
The one I chose, Steve. The one that's incorrect. That's the one I chose. Thank you.
That would be the fiction.
The third one, the FRB.
That's the fiction? Okay.
Right.
All right. Kara?
Oh, gosh.
Kara, I love when you make that noise.
every week it's a little different.
I know. Researchers are developing artificial compound eyes for autonomous vehicles and robots because they have superior peripheral vision and motion detection. I thought flies have horrific peripheral vision, but they have good motion detection. Aren't you supposed to catch a fly by, like, putting your hands over top of it, and then as soon as it moves, just clap them because they fly straight up, but they're like too dumb to notice that you're above them.
We see fly. We can't comment on that, Kara. We'd be helping you if we did.
Oh, geez. Okay. A newly published model predicts that the most cost-effective grid storage between now and 2050 for most applications will be hydrogen, like hydrogen fuel cells. Is that what we're talking about?
Hydrogen.
A newly published model predicts that the most cost-effective grid storage. I so don't understand. Anytime you guys launch into a conversation about grid storage for like a f-ing hour, I'm always like tuning out. I have no idea.
Which word don't you understand?
It's like, I just don't understand how grid storage works, well, I think. I don't understand the
Well, we don't really have a lot of grid storage right now. But so the grid, you know, the electrical grid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So just you need some way of storing energy so that when demand is less than production, you store the extra energy. And when
So everybody's been talking about using lithium-ion batteries, but now you're saying hydrogen.
Yeah, so basically hydrogen is one mechanism of storing energy. You convert whatever, you pull hydrogen off of something, water or something else, and you use energy to make the hydrogen, and then you burn the hydrogen later.
You store that and you burn it later. So it would have to be these like tanks of hydrogen would be the most cost effective, which to me seems like it would be not very cost effective because it would be expensive to have to store it without leaks. You'd have to use these massive tanks. I think you have to keep hydrogen cold in really cold storage. That doesn't seem, I don't know. I have no idea. I'm going to say that one's the fiction because it seems like there's probably like electrical ways to do it or battery ways to do it that are more cost effective in terms of their production. I don't know. I'll say that's the fiction just because I don't understand it.
Okay. Evan?
Well, I think I'm with Kara on this one because I think you were onto something with more traditional battery storage because the slow creep of battery technology, and you have to think by 2050, okay, well, that'll be the next generation, if not two generations later of battery storage. So that could do it. So I'm leaning towards that one being the fiction. The other two just seem less questionable in my mind. So I'll go with Kara and say that one's the fiction.
And Bob.
Okay, so number one there, the artificial compound eyes. Yeah, I mean, I know that compound eyes are great for motion detection. I mean, obviously, if you've got, say, you've got 50 separate eyes, anything that moves even a tiny bit will move for every eye. So motion detection, for sure. Peripheral vision, I'm not sure. I think it just depends on how those eyes are arranged. It doesn't necessarily need to follow how they're arranged for the normal insect compound eyes. Mm. The third one, the repeating faster radio bursts. Sure, we found one repeater already. I'm sure we could find another one. I mean, especially since this is probably overwhelmingly likely to be a natural thing and not something that's created artificially by aliens. So we're just going to find more and more of these, and hopefully we'll have a good idea what the hell is causing them. So that means that the second one, the grid storage, is, I think that's fiction. I think, I don't think it would, it, hydrogen's the most cost effective, method. And the other ones are just too plausible. So I'll have to say that one's fiction and go with Evan and Kara.
All right, so Jay, you're by yourself this week with the FRBs. Everyone else is on the hydrogen. So you all agree with the first one, so we'll start there. Researchers are developing artificial compound eyes for autonomous vehicles and robots because they have superior peripheral vision and motion detection. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Yay!
That's so good so all far. Right. So, Bob, you repeated a common myth about compound eyes. The image is not repeated in each eye. That is not how they work.
Well, I mean, it's not identical, but it's
similar. No, it's not at all. That is has nothing to do with how they work.
I have seen I have seen images of compound eyes.
They're fake.
Working.
They're not. Holy that's not God, how they
lied
work.
To me.
Oh,
it's just crazy.
They lied to all of us, Bob.
The difference is with the compound eyes is that you have a lens, right? A lens and the light sensitive. Cells make up like a little mini eye, and you have hundreds or thousands of those structures spread out across the eye. Some insects can have as many as 30,000 of these units, but each one is looking in a slightly different direction. So it's not repeating any images. It's just instead of a smooth retina, you have this faceted, multiple lenses, right? Instead of one big lens and a smooth retina. Just a different evolutionary path, for eyes to take. Each facet is called the omatidia. It has a lens, cornea, and the photoreceptor cells as a unit. And there's thousands of omatidia or units in one eye.
And I guess if individual ones get damaged, then the other ones are still okay.
Yeah. But just like got a part of your retina was damaged, the rest of it would still work. It's the same thing. Mm. But because of the way that it's formed, so you have an eye looking out to the side that's the same, as an omatidia looking out in the middle. So the peripheral vision is great.
So why isn't it seeing similar? So each little facet is seeing a different part of the scene?
Yeah, so it produces an image which has been likened to how like newspaper prints an image out of black dots, right? So each omatidia produces one dot, which is colored, right? Because they have color vision. And then that gets put together into one compound image. So you're just seeing one image still, like vertebrate eyes do. It's not these multiple overlapping images like is often portrayed. It's just produced in a different way as a compound image of dots with each omatidia producing one pixel, if you will.
And so because an eye is a sphere, they're all facing in like slightly different directions.
Yeah, right. And each one, it's the best way to think about it is that each one's a pixel to the image, right? Uh-huh. The pixels aren't reproduced or replicated. Each one's a different little pixel.
Wow.
So where compound eyes are vastly inferior to vertebrate eyes is in resolution. So even the most complex compound eye may have tens of thousands of omatidia. An eagle's eye has millions of photoreceptor cells in one tiny area. They just have orders of magnitude more resolution.
Yeah, their phobias must be intense.
Yeah, than the insect eyes. But if you think about a car, right, a self-driving car, what does it need? It doesn't necessarily need crystal clear, very, very sharp images, but it does need to see all around,
yeah,
and it does need to be very sensitive to movement. Mm-hmm. So they're saying, well, maybe the compound eye is a better model for the imaging devices for robots and autonomous vehicles than a vertebrate eye. So, but that's very challenging to build, right? Because you need to, it's hard to get every facet to be uniform, and any differences in each facet will cause distortions in the image. So the science, the news item, is about a new technique to create more uniform artificial compound eyes. That was the incremental advance being made here. They use nanostructures. And they said kind of, if you look at it, it looks like kind of a shag carpet, you know, with each fiber being a photoreceptive structure. So neat. Yeah, so we may have insect eyes on our self-driving cars in the future, basically.
I like it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to number deux. A newly published model predicts that the most cost-effective grid storage between now and 2050 for most applications will be hydrogen. Bob, Evan, and Kara think this one is the fiction. Jay, you think this one is science. And this one is... Now, keep in mind that grid storage...
That was jarring.
Grid storage is different than in a car, right, Kara? So for a car, it needs to be light and safe and whatever. Grid storage, it's stationary. It could be underground.
Yeah, you can bury it in
you
the
You could bury
yard.
It. So the factors are very different. So as,
but you use the word, let me see, you use the word efficient,
yes,
right?
Cost-effective.
Cost-effective. Oh, cost-effective. Okay, so cost-effective. All right, so that would involve, yeah, the materials and, okay.
The whole life cycle, the entire, that's what the model did. They modeled the entire life cycle of 12 different grid storage options, mm-hmm. and they also projected the same improvement in costs for production. So they tried to say, like, in 2030 and in 2040, like, how much are these likely to cost?
Mm.
So this one is the fiction.
It is.
Yep.
Okay. So what do you guys think was the most cost-effective grid storage option?
A battery.
A lithium-ion battery.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yep. I don't know if any of you guys saw that item, but...
Did not see it.
Nope. Yeah.
But so that means that we should be buying these maybe not the Powerwall, but like every solar company makes them now too, the right? Powerwall.
Yeah, so it's just that, and this is partly what I was talking about earlier in the show, that there's this steady incremental improvement in lithium-ion batteries, but also the cost of production is going way down as they're being mass-produced. And if you look at the whole life cycle versus other things, for most applications, lithium-ion batteries for grid storage is actually the most cost-effective option. Now, there are some specific situations where pumped hydro might be better, or even hydrogen might be better, but for most applications, lithium-ion batteries, they're saying, according to this model that they published, is the best way to go.
Wait, you just said pumped hydro. What is that? Is that water?
Pumped hydro is water, yeah. That's when you basically have a reservoir. And you pump water up the reservoir when you have excess electricity, and then you have hydroelectric when to get the power back out. That's the most efficient way for grid storage. But unfortunately, it's very limited because it could only be where it could be, right? You need to have a reservoir. So, yeah.
And most people don't have a reservoir in their backyard.
It's not cool sci-fi, you know?
It's great. Pumped hydro is great when the terrain allows for it. It is a great option.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Steve, what type of lithium-ion batteries were they talking about? Modern, you know, like current state-of-the-art?
Yeah.
Yep. Current state-of-the-art. So that's only going to get better. It's only going to get more and more cost-effective.
I know. Absolutely. This means that astronomers report the detection of the second known repeating FRB source using Canada's Chime radio telescope is science. Bob, I made you go last because I figured you saw this.
Yeah, I did see that one, but I still would have picked the second one because it was made less sense. But yep. Yeah, I did see that. It was cool. Yep.
Yeah. So this is number two. So there we go. We've just been talking about this, that they found one repeating source, and they're probably going to find others. And if they do, that would highly suggest that this is a natural phenomenon. And there we go. Didn't take long.
Or some sort of super advanced technology that we can't comprehend that other civilizations also stumbled, you know, also jumped on.
Yeah. Whatever.
Very unlikely, though. Amazingly so.
Yeah, and there's some other interesting aspects of it. So we are learning more about FRBs. So this is a new phenomenon. Again, it's fast radio bursts. They're very short. They're in the radio frequency. They're very powerful.
Amazingly
Yeah, we don't know what's causing them. This latest one was lower frequency. So this shows that FRBs could be in the low frequency range of radio waves. And also it demonstrates scattering, which tells us something about the environment in which it was produced.
Yes.
So we're getting these little clues about where and how they're being produced and what kind of pattern. So, you know, in five to 10 years, you know, or whatever, if we keep gathering more data, more FRBs, we'll get a more, it's like little puzzle pieces. We'll get a more complete picture and may be able to figure out exactly what's producing them. Very interesting astronomical mystery at present.
Yeah, it's fascinating because we know so many of these exotic phenomena that occur in the universe. Amazing things, you know, from black hole mergers to magnetars, such fascinating stuff that we had no clue about even, you know, when I was even growing up. And so now there's just something here that's producing tremendous amount of energy, and they don't know, they still don't know, really know what it is. So that's just like, well, what other new thing is out there? What's happening that we just can't figure out yet? It's some other, the universe is endlessly fascinating. I love it.
And this is a science mystery that we are figuring out in real time. Yeah. You know, this is a story we are following as it unfolds, you know, and as these new discoveries are made, we'll talk about it. And at some point on the show, we'll be saying, hey, we figured out what FRBs are.
Oh, I hope so. In our lifetime, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, like the solar neutrino problem. I mean, there's endless ones, but it's great to have such a mystery for years and then be like, yep, we nailed that one. And now we know what's going on with the neutrinos.
All right, good job, guys. Evan, you have a quote for us?
I do have a quote. We need to learn to differentiate between credible sources and evidence-scarce websites, between scientific consensus and cherry-picked one-off studies. Taking just the first step to try and fact-check before sharing information is hugely beneficial. And that was a quote from Coven Synapathy.
We've had on the show.
Yes.
It's funny. You sent
mom.
You sent me that quote, and I was reading. I'm like, oh, this sounds like it's coming from a real skeptic, and it was. Because so many quotes from scientists and philosophers, and they're even when they're very pithy, they're not like really hitting the skeptical nail on the head. And this was, so I could tell it was from a fellow skeptic.
Definitely.
Cool. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
So quick announcement, I will be in Tucson, Arizona next Saturday. So that's Saturday, January 19th. And I will be getting together with the local skeptics, with the Tucson skeptics.
Yeah.
So if you are in Arizona and you want to hang out with me for a Saturday night, I'll be there for a medical thing. But I always like to hook up with the local skeptics when I'm traveling. Just check the Tucson Skeptics website for the details. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. Brother.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.